Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, one and all, and welcome to another Book and a Chat with me, Story Heart, as your host. Tea's made, so I'm ready to go. And my special guest today, actually, I'm quite honoured because normally we get sort of, one or two books. This one is a very special author, and that is Karen White. Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's a pleasure. Well, it's raining here in Connecticut, which is not unusual lately. So what's it like where you are?
It's both. They lied, as usual. They said it was going to be sunny and warm, and it looks pretty dreary and drizzly outside at the moment, and it doesn't seem warm at all.
I bet the garden centers are wishing it was.
I know. We need to put something out front. It looks like Deadzil out there, but, you know, the weather just doesn't cooperate.
No, that's right. We dug a hole yesterday for a raised vegetable pot. It's now a pond, so.
Yeah. So why bother? You know, that's what I told my husband. Just put plastic things out there. It'll be fine.
Yeah, we might get some ducks, you know.
There you go.
Okay, well, I said, you know, this is great to actually talk to somebody who has such a success story. I mean, you've now, what, your 10th book?
Yes, this is my 10th book.
And that's since 2000?
Yes, yes.
Wow, which is about the time I came over to America.
Okay.
So in the time I've been, that's obviously it. In the time I've been here, you've just become so famous.
You're my good luck charm, apparently.
Well,
Thank you.
The thing is, because, you know, what it is, we both went to school in London.
Yes, okay.
Well, I was just outside London. I was right on the north edge of London.
Okay.
So how was that? You're going to school over in England?
I loved it, except for the weather. I think living in London is truly one of the, you know, top five best experiences of my entire life. It was just wonderful. I loved living in the city. We lived on Regent's Park, so we didn't have a car for the Yeah, we didn't have a car for the 7 years we lived there. It was all public transportation. You know, we walked everywhere, and it's the architecture of the city, the history of the city. I mean, it was just such a blessing to live in such an incredible place, and I really think it, you know, it stimulated that sort of writer soul that I have. And, you know, it just makes me look at things differently, I think, living in such a place as London. And I would, you know, I always wish that I could give that experience to my children. Unfortunately, it hasn't really worked out that way. But, you know, it is certainly 7 years that I will always, always treasure.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, in London, central London itself, you don't need a car. You absolutely don't. You've got the underground, you've got the public transport. And in fact, you have to pay to take a car into London these days.
Really, and I've heard that. I've heard it's gotten really bad. And even when I lived there, and that was, you know, in the early 80s, late 70s, well, at least then, you know, the tube was very, very safe. I never had a problem coming home at night. And, you know, but even back then, the people that we knew that did have cars, it was so expensive to park a car and keep a car and to find parking for it. It was just, it was lovely not having to deal with that. And when we took our little excursions into the countryside, we would rent a car. You know, that was no big deal.
Yeah.
Except for my father forgetting to stay on the other side of the road. But,
well,
but besides that, it was fine.
There's a whole story behind that. I actually blogged it a couple of weeks ago about why we drive on the left. I mean, it goes back to medieval times. And
you know, and I once knew the story, and I don't know it anymore. But it is very interesting, and it is a logical thing.
Yeah.
But
most people being right-handed, defend knights on horseback, draw the sword across them to defend themselves on the right hand side. That's what.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. That's it. And so it's really kind of romantic, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Americans come along, and they screw
it all
up.
It was actually the French. It was the French who changed it to the right, because during the French Revolution, the aristocracy always used to travel down the left, and in fact, the Pope said, you know, you have to travel on the left on pilgrimages and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And the aristocracy always used to charge down the left and knock the peasants over to the right-hand side of the road. So when the French Revolution came along, the peasants
said
we're not going to do that. We're not going to take any notice. We're going to go down the right-hand side. And then it moved to America, and I think Philadelphia was the first people who made it law to travel on the right. Something like that.
Wow. Interesting. Figures, leave it to the French. Yeah.
They're back with it. Don't get me started on the French. Never get an Englishman started on the French. It's been the same since 1066, you know.
There you go, hadn't changed.
to what I've read about you, we're lucky that you actually became a writer because you could have become a film star.
Apparently, according to my grandmother, yes.
Yeah, I mean, according to what it was, in the seventh grade, you played hooky from school. Well, we're not going to go there.
Yeah, the only time I've ever played hooky, okay, it was to read a book, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
I'm not really a bad egg.
I bet your children really like that bit.
They do. They're like, oh my gosh, Mom, you were such a nerd.
You played hooky to read Gone with the Wind.
That's correct.
So then it was a choice of being a writer or becoming Scarlett O'Hara.
That's correct. You know, there's something about all the great, great novels out there. And, you know, and I think it varies by reader, but any book that you read that totally sucks you in so that you are not even aware that you're living your own life, you are living the lives of those characters. And Gone with the Wind was the first book that, you know, I've been an avid reader my whole life, but I never had that experience before. I was mesmerized. I really thought I was Scarlett O'Hara while reading that book. I mean, you know, being the stupid 12, 13-year-old I was at the time, you know, I remember going to school and, like, speaking like her. That's how nerdy I was. You know, looking for my Rhett Butler.
frankly, I don't give a damn to the teachers. Yeah.
You know, but I was just totally immersed, and I read it multiple times, you know, that year in seventh grade, because nobody wanted to go see the movie with me because I'd memorized so much of the dialogue, you know.
Oh, you're the person who sits there narrating it behind you when you're trying to watch it.
Exactly.
It was you, now I know.
Oh, my daughter won't even watch movies with me anymore, but, you know, that are based on books I've read, because she's like, you're just going to ruin it, you're just going to talk the whole way through.
Tell the ending before it happens, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's, you know, and I guess, I don't know, you know, the whole movie star thing, I don't know, that's not me. And like I said, I've always been just such a voracious reader, and my teachers always encouraged me to be a writer.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You know, you decided you wanted to become a writer, and they helped you and encouraged you?
They encouraged me, but I never thought I could do it. I honestly didn't. I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, when I'm given a five-page essay, it takes everything out of me. You know, I just couldn't imagine writing a 400-page manuscript, for crying out loud. That was something all those people I saw in libraries and bookstores did, you know, but that wasn't something I could do. And I also, you know, I've played piano my whole life, so I have good hand-eye coordination,
uh-huh.
But I cannot, the physical act of handwriting is so hard for me. My handwriting is illegible. My kids, you know, if I had to write a note to their teachers, they'd want me to type it, because otherwise the teacher would think that they wrote it, you know, because it's so childish and horrible. And, you know, it used to embarrass my mother. She's such a Southerner and has the most perfect, beautiful cursive, and mine always looked like, you know, a horse had written it. And so I just never thought, I just couldn't imagine actually, you know, writing a book. And then I learned how to type when I was a sophomore. And, you know, on a manual typewriter, I was doing like 90 words a minute without errors.
Wow.
Because I played piano, you know, so it wasn't that hard of a stretch. And that sort of opened my eyes a little bit, like, oh, this isn't, you know, this is, I think the thing is that my thoughts were always faster than my handwriting could keep up.
I can relate to that so much. Throughout my school life in English and things like that, it's always a case, he's got it there, but his brain's ahead of his hand sort of thing.
And you lose it. You know, you lose what you're thinking because you're going back and trying to rewrite what you already thought. And it was very frustrating for me. And then when I learned to type, I'm like, oh. I mean, it was just this huge realization. I still didn't think I could write a book. And then I read another one of those earth-changing kind of books like that I had experienced when I read Gone with the Wind. When my kids were babies, I read, my sister-in-law said, you've got to read this book. And it was Outlander by Diana Gabaldon. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
The name rings a bell, yeah.
It's unbelievable. You know, huge New York Times. I mean, it was just a blockbuster hit when it came out. And luckily, when I read the first one, she'd already written four in the series. So, I didn't have to wait, which was wonderful. But, I mean, I think I got arthritis in my hand from, I would take my kids to the... to the park, the playground, and put them in swings and just push them and push them and push them, and, you know, with one hand, and with the other hand have this really thick, thick book held open in the other. You know, 3 hours later, Mommy, can we go home now? No, I'm not done with this chapter. Please, Mom, take us home. It's raining.
That's so good. I totally agree with you about getting into a book and becoming part of the, becoming the person in the book.
Yes.
And I think that, I mean, I can, you know, from what I've read of your books, that's something that a lot of people have picked up on. Because you become the person as you write it,
Absolutely.
It makes the character more realistic. And that's why
Absolutely.
People love your books so much.
I think so. And I wonder why I always have to take a nap after I have a writing session. And I think it's because I do like, you know, they said Vivian Leigh went a little crazy when she did the character in a Streetcar Named Desire, because the character she played was a little mentally unstable. And Vivian Leigh, the reason why she was such a great actress was that she became that character, how regardless of mental illness or whatever, and she got a little crazy while creating the character. I think it was Stella. But and that's kind of how I feel when I get into these characters. I become them. I sort of channel them in a way, and I'm just so mentally exhausted when I'm done, but that's how I know I've done it right, because
it's the intensity. And as you say, you sort of it's almost like you're being sucked into the character, and then when you finish, you've got to sort of shake yourself back out of it.
Yes, exactly. It's like being an actress. I truly play the roles of each character that I create.
I think that's wonderful, and you know that's what I find when I write my book and that. But
mm-hmm,
I think
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of authors out there who perhaps don't do that so much. They might be literally brilliant and can
yes.
sort of dash down hundreds of words, you know, like a thesaurus of different versions of the same word almost.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet the characters, something about them, they're
very one-dimensional.
Yeah, one-dimensional, yeah.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. I judge a lot of contests and I read a lot of unpublished works for critique purposes, and it's so hard for me to teach that. I think it's something that's natural, that I was born with it. And I don't know if it's something you can learn, but I've read, you know, really good, they've got really interesting characters and a really interesting plot line, but when I finish reading it, it's completely forgettable. I don't know who the characters are, I don't remember them, I don't remember their names or much about them, because they were so one-dimensional, although it was a perfectly acceptable book. You know, and I think that's the author just isn't getting inside the characters' heads enough.
And I think that's funny because what you said at the start of that, because I don't think you can teach a person. You can teach a person to write, but you can't teach a person to tell a story.
That's true. I think that.
You see these people that go along to the writing seminars and they listen to people and they go to, you know, in my case, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators meetings and
mm-hmm.
all this sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they come up. But if the imagination isn't there, if the sort of being the character, if telling the story isn't there, and you can't learn some of that. You know, you can polish it up a bit,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
to actually learn it, I don't think you can do that.
Exactly. Like, we could all learn to play basketball, but we can't all play like Michael Jordan. You know, I think there's certain things that people are born with, and everybody has something. It just takes a while sometimes to figure out what it was. I mean, I didn't really think that I could write until, you know, I was in my early 30s. So,
I always wrote little bits, but what I can't do is spell. So it wasn't.
Thank God for spell check. Yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't until spell check came along.
I know. I use it on my emails, you know, for crying out loud. I think sometimes you're just not thinking about it. And I love it when I have a critique partner, Wendy Wax. She also writes for Penguin. But it's so funny because she sees all my stuff raw, you know, before I've really gone through. I mean, I edited a lot before I sent it to her, but a lot of it. And some of the things that that have shown up, you know, like roll, R-O-L-L, instead of R-O-L-E, you know, so it takes on like a completely different meaning. And just like, you know, you're writing the story, you're not paying attention to the,
well,
to the spelling,
and also,
you know.
And also, I mean, you know, the word, the spelling between English and American.
Yes, yes.
It's so totally different. I mean,
and even the meanings of words are different, really be different, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I do, when I go to the schools, one of the things I do is sort of, and one of the things in my book is like the word comparisons, you know, like on a car, hood and bonnet and
right.
And you know, trunk and boot and stuff like that. And one of the things from my book is how my Fred Squire is like a 15-year-old gets into trouble with the words. And you do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I've been here coming, what, 9 years now, and I'm still getting into trouble. I sat at a meeting a month ago. In fact, I had a TV thing this week, and I mentioned this at that. And somebody asked me if somebody said something. You know, did so-and-so say something to you about it? And I said, no, they didn't say a dicky bird. Now, that's a standard English thing.
I know.
But the people in the meeting just looked at me like I got three heads. Yeah.
Like, what in the heck? Is that another language? Yeah. Wasn't that what they say, America and England, two countries separated by a common language?
Yeah, Bernard Shaw said that, yeah, and it's true. I mean, yeah, you know, my wife's American, my children are American, but they see both sides. Yeah, you know? my children, they know if Daddy says this, he means this. Yeah. You know?
Well, you know, people ask me since I lived in London for so long. You know, oh, are you ever going to set a book there? And I mean, I'll have to go back and visit. Actually, my daughter wants to go to England for her senior trip when she graduates from high school next year.
Right.
She's a big Jane Austen fan.
Oh,
and,
right. She's been up the north, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, but she wants to spend some time in London because she's also a big shopper. you know, people are always asking me, you know, are you going to write a book set in London? And so, yes, I'll have to go back and research because it's changed a great deal since I lived there in the 20s.
It's changed. I mean, I go back every year and it's changed, you know.
It's different, yeah. So I'll need to go back, darn, you know, that's the toughest part.
Well, what you want to do is go back when the Olympics are on and then you see everything, you know.
Oh gosh, I couldn't take the crowds. I really couldn't. but what I'd love to do, because my forte, you know, is Southern women's fiction. You know, my character's always Southern. It's what I know. You know, my parents are both from Mississippi. All my relatives live in the South. Although I married a Yankee from Brooklyn, and you know, because I lived kind of all over the world, it's kind of nice. I have a different perspective, I think, looking at Americans and the South in particular, and I think that gives me a sort of not easier, but it gives me a different perspective when I create my Southern characters. But I would love to do a fish out of water story, a Southern American expatriate living in London. You know,
yeah.
I just think that would be such a fun thing. But again, I will have to go back and relearn all those words that I, you know, I used to always say Lou all the time, or my brawly, or you know, whatever, my wellies and all of that. And I've stopped doing that, obviously, because people would look at me like, what are you talking about, you know?
Well, I understand that, because my next book is going from Brit, who's the sort of girlfriend of my hero. She actually goes from America to England.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas to start off with, it's an English boy coming to America.
The next
book is Across the Pond and Back Again. So she, they actually get some. It's a long story, but they get given some tickets, and she's going to go and spend some time in England. So I'm going to have the reversal. But luckily, obviously, all my family's English, so I still have daily contact with what's going on in England. So.
Oh, absolutely. And then you live in the States, so you have both perspectives
there.
That's really great. Yeah.
Now, let's start talking about some of your books. Your book, The House on Trad Street, that has been put in for an award, yeah?
Yeah, several awards, actually. I'm very excited.
Wow.
It was my quirky novel idea, but it's up right now for the Southern Independent Booksellers Association 2009 Book of the Year Award. It's also up for Romance Writers of America's Reader Award, which is sort of like the Oscars in their mainstream category.
That's the one I heard about. I mean, that's fantastic, you know.
Yeah. And then I've been nominated for the Georgia Author of the Year Award for that book as well. So it's doing really well.
So
and
I bow down
funny.
To you now, yeah.
Well, you know, it was one of those quirky ideas that, you know, I was writing these Southern women's fiction books with Penguin, and they were doing well. You know, I was growing my readership. I was, you know, every book I was doing, you know, better and better, you know, by these increments. And I was happy to do a book a year. That's really all I really recommend is doing a book a year. But then I had this quirky idea of a sort of National Treasure meets Sixth Sense meets Moonlighting kind of book set in Charleston. Sort of it's about a 39-year-old Charleston realtor who sees dead people and she's in denial about it. And she's really anal retentive and loves ABBA. And I just thought, oh, that would be the coolest thing. It would be this great series. And her sidekick is this true crime historical mystery writer. And she inherits this old house in Charleston that she doesn't want. And he's researching the disappearance of a woman who lived in the house in the 1930s. And so they kind of, you know, there's ghosts and mysteries and their relationship. And I just had this idea. And, you know, my agent was like, oh, this is really cool. Let me, you know, she sent it to my publisher. And my publisher was like, yeah, this is really cool. We want to publish this and the sequel. But we also want you to still do this Southern Women's Fiction every year, so you're going to have to do two books a year if you want to do this other book.
That's what I was going to ask, because people who've heard my radio blog, you know that I love following the young bloggers, the sort of teen, young adult bloggers who they're the ones who go out, buy the books, wait for the books, queue up for the books. And
yes, gotta love them.
I love following them. So they might have 20, 30, or there was one the other day, I had 200 followers, you know. But they are the ones who really get into the stuff. And
mm-hmm.
I've heard on two sites, they said, I was waiting for the follow-up to The House on Trad Street, and suddenly
yes.
The Lost Hours came out. You know?
I know. Like, what the heck is going on here? You know, if I could write books faster, I would. But, there's got to be some time in between. But, you know, the good thing is that, so this book came out, and it is, oh, my gosh. I mean, I feel like Britney Spears with the amount of fan mail I'm getting for The House on Trad Street.
Well,
all I
see is nothing but fantastic reports about, you know, your books, your writing, and everybody loves the new book. Tell us about the new book, The Lost Hours.
The Lost Hours, that, you know, it came to me actually about, I don't know, two Winter Olympics ago when Peekaboo Street was this, you know, American Olympian hopeful, gold medal Olympic hopeful in several skiing events. And, you know, here's this young woman who spent her whole life for, you know, waiting for this one moment, and the day before her first event, she breaks her leg.
Yeah.
I remember crying. Like, I internalized her pain so much. I just couldn't believe this disappointment. And I guess when I was creating this character, Piper, for The Lost Hours, that's what I drew on. Piper was an Olympic equestrian hopeful. But the thing that kind of separates her a little bit is when she was 6 years old, she was in a car accident with her parents, where both her parents were killed, and she's been raised with her by her grandparents in Savannah, Georgia. I love, you know, the whole low country setting.
Right.
But she thinks she's invincible now. She believes that God has done the worst thing to me. I am invincible. I can get on the back of a horse and, you know, jump these impossibly high barriers because the worst that has ever happened to me has already happened.
So it's a bit
and then
like
she has
Velvet, you know.
And it's been years since I read that, but, you know, but the whole horse thing, and my daughter's a rider. She's a hunter-jumper. So literally within a stone's throw of about 10 horse farms here. So it wasn't very hard for me to do the research and get help, you know, from the experts. But so that's what happens to Piper. She has this, you know, horrible accident, and she really thinks her life is over. And then she gets a key to a hidden room in the attic of her grandparents' house, and that
like
is literally
a secret garden sort of thing.
It is. It opens her future. It opens her life. She basically is immersed into her grandmother's story. She never thought her grandmother had a story to tell, and this is telling. And her grandmother at the beginning of the book has Alzheimer's. And so can't help her, and she finds her grandmother's scrapbook, and along with it a newspaper clipping about the body of an infant found floating in the Savannah River in 1939, and she realizes too late that she should have listened to her grandmother when she still had time. So sort of, you know, she sort of uncovers her past and her grandmother's past at the same time, and it's, you know, I always throw a little bit of a mystery, a little bit of a love story, but it's always a woman's journey. And set against the beautiful backdrop of Savannah, it's definitely the kind of book that I like to read.
Well, all I've read about in all these pages is how much people love your writing, and even though people were waiting for the follow-up to Trad Street,
I'm
this came
sorry.
Along. No, no, That,
it's out in November, okay?
Oh, November. Well, I'll pass the word on. So that, there you go. If anybody is waiting for the follow-up to The House of Trad Street, it's coming out in November. So
you want
a Christmas present,
there's
a Christmas present. You know?
And let them know that it's doing so well that my publisher just asked for two more books in the series, so there will be a total of four.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. It's killing me, but anything for my readers.
This is what I love, you know, because, yeah, I've had authors, I've had the bloggers on. I try and get as many different sort of people as I can, and people, you know, first book, or, you know, this might be the second book. You've just success to success to success. It's wonderful to hear such a success story.
Well, thank you. I mean, it hasn't been smooth sailing. I mean, you know, I did, I was dropped by my second publisher before I was with Penguin, so, you know, there's been ups and downs, but you know what I did when I didn't have a contract? I kept writing, and I tell that to everybody. When you hit a brick wall, keep writing. I wrote, you know, two books without a contract so that when I did sign my contract with Penguin, I already had two books down. So
yeah, I mean, the person who dropped you must be seeing
well,
what
I'm trying to be really quiet about it because my current publisher, the rights are about to revert back to me for two of those books, publisher wants to re-release them, so I'm trying to keep really on the down low here, or the low down, whatever it's called.
Okay, it's funny because while I was trying to get my book published, I went to, you know, these seminars where people give you, like, their views on the first three chapters and all this sort of stuff. And I went to one, and you paid for the seminar on the first three chapters, and I don't think the person actually read the book because they seemed to forget about me till right near the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, you know, you had the one-to-one meeting, and they basically ripped the book apart. And you know, oh, this is no good, this is this. And I wish I knew who it was because I'd love to send them all the reviews that are on Amazon.
Yes.
You know,
I'm waiting for the day. I am so waiting for the day. I mean, I was raised by a Southern woman, so I know never to be, you know, it'll all be very subtle, but they'll know what it is and who I'm talking about when the time comes.
Exactly. It'll come around.
It will. And you know, it always does. I try not to be mean or nasty to anybody because, you know what, especially in the publishing world, it's such an incestuous sort of business. Everybody, you know, one person leaves this publishing house and goes there. So you never burn your bridges.
No, that's
you
correct.
Never
quite
do
right.
That.
I mean, you know, especially in these times, you know, things are changing every 5 minutes. I mean, my eldest niece, she works for a publishing house in London.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's been there 2-3 years, and she's the longest person within her area that's been there.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's, you know, she says, well, I ought to be looking to move on because everybody else has moved that I started with, sort of thing.
Oh, God, she feels like a dinosaur.
Well, you don't realize how these things go on. Anyway, we're coming up to the last couple of minutes of the show. So this, I will now hand this over to you so you can do all the blogs, publicity, web pages,
all
your books, where people can get them from, et cetera, you want.
Absolutely.
So over to you, Karen.
Thank you. I always send everything you ever wanted to know about Karen White and her books, including my blog tour, I'm going on a physical book tour in 2 weeks. Everything you ever wanted to know or see or do about Karen or enter my contest, join my mailing list, read excerpts. It's www.karen-white.com. And that tells you everything about my books and about me. There's pictures. It's fun. Go there. Thank you.
How are you enjoying your virtual book tour?
I love it. It's hard at first writing all those blogs and everything.
That's right.
But it's,
yeah.
You know, I'm in between books right now, so it's kind of, it keeps my writing stuff going in between books. So it's been fun. And this podcast stuff is really fun.
I went with the same people with Pump Up Your Book Promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I had such a wonderful time. I mean, I was in Australia, I was in Korea, I was in Italy. And at the time, I was recovering from back surgery. Yeah,
because you're doing it at home.
Yeah.
I know.
And I met such wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's really great.
And the thing I got was when the month, or however long it was up, it was like the last night of a show. You know, what am I going to do tomorrow?
Start the next book.
Oh, that's right. I mean, the thing is, everybody says, well, you were laying in bed. You should have been able to start your next book. Yeah, but I just wasn't up to doing it.
Well, yeah, it's exhausting. It really is. It takes a lot out of you mentally,
it was,
you know, as creative types.
the mental capacity, just lying in bed recovering for, you know, a month and a half, 2 months, my brain became fried, you know.
Yes.
You want to do this, you want to read the stuff, and you just can't concentrate.
Exactly. It's like finishing a book,
Karen,
I'm jello.
That's right. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise.
So quickly. Every success to your current book.
Thank you.
I know it's going to be a great book. And I know that
Thank you.
Next one for Tragedy is going to be a great book. So that's November, so we've got to spread the word about it.
Yeah, and that's The Girl on Legree Street.
You've been asked to do a couple more on it as well, so I'm sure everybody's going to have a great time. So anyway, that's it from me,
thank
Barry.
You.
With time's beating us again, I'll say goodbye for now. And
thank you
again, Karen.
Thanks
and
for
I'll
having
sign
me.
Out as I came over here like this.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking its